Hi, this is Andrew.
And this is Amy, and in this episode, AADL talks to Wayne Kramer.
While he was in Ann Arbor for the events surrounding the 40th anniversary of the John Sinclair Freedom Rally, we had the chance to talk with guitarist and co-founder of the MC5, Wayne Kramer. Wayne talks about the influence of John Sinclair, jazz, and Detroit culture on his life and music, his struggles with drug and alcohol abuse, and how they led to his current work. He also recalls his favorite concert in West Park and his signature guitar.
I want to ask you, first of all, about that guitar last night, the red, white, and blue guitar. Is there a story behind it?
Well, that particular guitar is a commercially available Fender Signature Stratocaster, Wayne Kramer signature model, which I'm very proud of. It's very humbling to be a guitar player and one day find yourself with a signature model. You know, for a kid that grew up looking at Fender catalogs and thinking maybe someday I could own one, to having my own signature model is a pinnacle of my life as an artist or a professional musician. So, and it's a reproduction of the Stratocaster that I built and played in the Kick Out the Jams era of the MC5. And, you know, I felt like I wanted the band to have a look and that we were putting on a show, a performance, and that everything you did was part of the performance. And I admired Pete Townsend, and he wore this jacket that was cut out of red, white, and blue motif like the Union Jack. And I thought, you know, that's very cool, but I'm not British, but I am American, and maybe I could use like the American flag motif on my guitar. And it was also a way to make a political statement, which was that although I disagreed violently and militantly with American policies, that I was expressing my patriotism and my belief in the founding principles of America in protest by embracing the symbol of the flag and letting it be known that, you know, I'm really opposed to actions that the government's taking that I think are immoral and unethical.
So how did the MC5 start and develop a sound that wasn't like anything that had come before?
The sound that the MC5, I guess, is recognized for, this kind of aggressive guitar-based music, it really came about as a result of a confluence of many influences. I came up in the 50s, and the era of the electric guitar was just emerging. Chuck Berry was the leading proponent of a whole new style of guitar playing, where the guitar had a tone to it that was really from the amplifier, not the traditional sound of an acoustic guitar, but it was an electric sound, and he played it with a velocity that was exciting. And there were a few other guitar players around that were pushing the envelope. So that's where I started. And then in the middle 60s, with the coming of the British first wave, there were guitar players from England. I mentioned Pete Townsend as a huge influence, and Jeff Beck. And I really admired what these guys were doing. I thought they were pushing the guitar further. But the real portal that opened up the door for the sound that became the MC5 sound and my approach to the guitar was in the music of the free jazz movement. So when I heard John Coltrane go from traditional scales and modes into what the one critic called sheets of sound, that I saw there was a way to push this music beyond traditional Western music. And My fellows in the band, we all were on the same wavelength about trying to do this in the rhythm section, you know, to have the drummer play outside the tempo rather than lock down the tempo and the tone of the instrument itself, that I actually played the amplifier as much as I played the guitar. That's how we ended up there.
Did you talk about just becoming a jazz band becoming
jazz
combo?
No, because we couldn't play that well. No, we were rock and roll kid. You know, I could play three chords. I could play the Dickens out of those three chords, but I didn't know anything about complex harmony or music theory or how to improvise through chord changes. I hadn't learned any of those things yet, you know. But we admired them as people, and we admired them as a lifestyle, and we heard what they were doing. We couldn't play that, but we were inspired by them and probably attached a great significance that wasn't actually meant to be there, but that's the way it is when you smoke a lot of marijuana and take acid and listen to the same record over and over and over again.
I was thinking about this last night. You weren't at the original rally 40 years ago, and I know that the rift between the MC5 and Sinclair is legendary, and I'm just kind of wondering, you obviously patched it up at some point with John, and I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, set the record straight on what happened. And
when someone gets ready to go to prison, prison is a really traumatic experience. I mean, most people can't relate to it, and as well they shouldn't. It's an absolutely horrific experience. And oftentimes you want to blame somebody. You don't want to take the responsibility that you created this situation, and maybe you didn't. But I think in the case of John's marijuana sentence and imprisonment, he was incredibly angry. And I think that he wanted to blame somebody. And I think I think when that happens, oftentimes you attack the people you're closest to. And I think that and I think he's right in thinking that he was made the scapegoat for all that the MC5 represented. You know, the fact that there's this rock band that's telling young girls to burn their brassieres and kids should go have sex and everyone should smoke marijuana and we should have no money and free everything for everybody. Well, you know, there was a great resistance to these ideas in teachers, parents, PTAs, prosecutors, lawyers, policemen, priests, people really opposed us. And so in a lot of ways, John was made the scapegoat. You know, that conviction, I mean, had he been a mild-mannered guy that no one had ever heard of, maybe he wouldn't have got that sentence. But because he was upfront about everything and everything we did was in the public eye. So, you know, in a lot of ways, John was the scapegoat for you know, what me and my band were doing. And we were all in it together. But he interpreted my attempt to have a conversation about what was I to do with the band should he go to prison. It was an eventuality that he couldn't face. And so when I tried to have the conversation with him, it became very awkward, and he took the position that I was selling him out and that the band was selling him out, and he was never in it for the money. He was always in it for the music. And, you know, those are admirable principles, but it didn't change the reality that if he went to prison, I still had to try to run a band, and I still had to pay for management, and I still wanted to contribute to John's defense, you know, and we did. We continued to play benefits for John's defense. And in fact, right after John was sent to prison, Fred Smith and I went to the Hill House and met with Lenny, and we brought money with us to give her, and we said, "Do you need money?" And she said, "No, we're going to be okay. We're fine." And we said, "Okay, well, if you need it, let us know. And, you know, we're here for you." So even though he feels like we sold him out, we never sold him out, and we never stopped loving him, and we never stopped admiring him. But it's an unfortunate human emotional reaction to an absolutely horrific set of pressures. So, You know, and then the whole thing was played out in the press. I had written him a letter trying to explain my how I felt, and he, of course, reacted bitterly and kind of a knee-jerk reaction. And it was really painful. It really hurt a lot because I always loved John, and I love him to this day, and he was always a great mentor of mine. But there was nothing I could do. I was powerless in the situation. And then, times progressed, and then the Freedom Rally concert came up, and Dave Sinclair wouldn't let the MC5 perform as a kind of way to stick it to the band. You know, we're going to get you guys. We're going to fix you. And, you know, these are human beings, and this is messy stuff, and I don't have any problem with any of it today. I understand it, and I can put myself in Dave's shoes. You know, here the MC5's off shooting heroin, driving sports cars, and John's in prison. You know, it doesn't look good. So, but the interesting thing was that my personal life went down the drain, and my professional life went down the drain, and I acquired a heroin habit and became involved in criminal activities and caught a federal narcotics trafficking case. And after John got out of prison, I went to John because I was worried about what was going to happen to me. And John was the only man that I knew that I trusted what he had to say, you know. And I said, you know, look, I've got this case. These agents are pressuring me. And what do you think I should do? And we talked, and it was like we were okay. And then I had to go to prison for about the same amount of time he did, 2.5 years. And when I came out of prison, it was like – everything was okay between us. Somehow he had to go and he had to do his time, and then I had to go and do my time. And then somehow that balanced the scales emotionally. I don't understand it, why it worked out that way, but I know it did, because when I got out, we re-upped immediately and resumed our friendship, and our friendship's been stronger than ever all these years since then. But it was a very hard time. You know, we were all under incredible pressure, and none of us knew how things were going to turn out and what direction things were going to go in. So I think I understand what happened and why it happened. I mean, I felt those same feelings when they told me I was going to have to go to prison. Well, you know, this ain't my fault, and this is somebody else, and. So it's I've wondered about that for the 30 years. Why did I have to go to prison? You know, why did John have to go to prison? And I have some ideas about those things now today. But that's what happened with that.
Can you talk about meeting John and how he became your manager, which happened pretty quickly after you meeting him, I think?
Rob Tyner, the MC5 singer, had been seeing a woman that lived down by Wayne State, and she was kind of in the periphery of this artist workshop world. And he had started to attend these poetry readings, and he would come back and tell me, man, you should see this, what's going on down there. He's like, they're beatniks, they're real beatniks, you know? And they do poetry, and it's great, you know. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, and this neighborhood is terrific. Like, you can rent apartments really cheap, you know, and nobody cares if you have long hair. And so I was 17. I left home, and I moved downtown, and I got one of those cheap apartments and had long hair and smoked marijuana and started getting a feel for the neighborhood and learning about this guy, John Sinclair, who was, in fact, in DeHoco, the Detroit House of Corrections, serving a 6-month sentence for his second conviction on a marijuana charge. And so we all heard that John Sinclair was coming home. He was coming home. He was going to be released. So everyone in the community put together this event at the artist workshop, and it was going to be an all-day celebration, and dancers were dancing, and poets were reading poetry, and the MC5, we said we would come and play, you know. And because we had been playing for beatniks before, and we liked playing for beatniks because first they didn't ask us to play the top 10. If we just played good music, they liked it, which was a new experience for us being a teenage rock band, you know, because most everywhere we tried to play, that's what they wanted to hear was whatever was being played on the radio. And we didn't want to do that. We wanted our own songs being on the radio. And we waited and waited and waited, and they kept putting us off and putting us off. And Charles Moore and his band played, and more poets read poetry, and more dancers danced. And it got later and later and later, and we waited around all day. And finally, like at 2 in the morning or some late hour, they finally said, okay, you guys can play. So we set up our gear, and we had these massive amplifiers, these gigantic Vox 100-watt amps. And we started rocking, and everybody's dancing. We're having a ball. And Lenny Sinclair came down and pulled the plug on us. And she just said she wasn't going to allow it because, you know, her husband had just come home from prison, and she didn't want to have the police come, and that's it. Get out. Stop it. So I started reading the kinds of things the Artist Workshop was putting out and the things what John was saying. And he was being kind of dismissive about rock in general. You know, he thought really he was being kind of an elitist snob about, the only real music is the blues and avant-garde jazz. But I knew the blues and avant-garde jazz. I'm listening to that music, too, and I'm in a band. And he said, well, the Artist Workshop is the community. And I said, well, I live in the community. I think him and Tyner had a exchange in the press. They were a little letter writing battle, you know. And then one day I just went over to Sinclair's house. He lived in the castle there on the service drive of the expressway, the John C. Lodge. And I just said, hi, I'm Wayne Kramer, and, you know, I got a band, and we live in the neighborhood here, and, you know, I'd like to know how we could work it out where maybe we could use the Artist Workshop to rehearse in. We need a place to rehearse. And he said, well, come on in. Let's smoke a joint and talk about it. And we just found out, like, we were way more alike than we were different, and that began a great friendship and a great kind of student-teacher relationship. John's a little older than me, and he's certainly better educated than I am. And John, you know, we smoked a lot of marijuana together, and we talked about everything and everybody, and how did things get the way they are, and things that I only knew on a gut level. That, you know, yeah, the system sucks. Yeah, everything sucks. I knew that. But I couldn't articulate it. I couldn't tell you why or how things became the way they were. And John had an idea about those things. So I enjoyed his company, and I enjoyed his analysis and his understanding of, like, and his help in how I could get my band organized and how we would do things. So you're right. It wasn't much time after that he became a huge fan of the band, like our number one supporter. And then I think he finally realized that, you know, I was trying to manage the band myself, and it was impossible. And he knew that I needed help. And I think that's when he stepped up and said that he would manage the band.
So did you convince him that there was a reason to like rock, or did he just finally realize that he had an opportunity here to manage a group and that they might be, you know, be able to pull something off? Or, you know, did he lose his elitism?
No, I don't think he did. But I think he heard in the MC5 that there was a possibility this band could actually break the mold, that this band was clearly listening to Sun Ra and listening to John Coltrane and Albert Eiler. And then after I met him, I started learning even more because he had a spectacular record collection. And I just go over to John's house and listen to records all day. And he would turn me on to, hey, but have you heard this? You know, Heliocentric World. Oh, have you heard Bells? You know, and so all these records. And they imprinted on me in a deeper way than music has imprinted on me in the rest of my life. You know, studies have been done about this where music imprints on young people's brains at a certain point. I think during puberty, just after puberty, that it gets set up in your neural pathways on a different plane than like I, you know, I've heard a lot of music in the 50 years that I've been playing the guitar, but that music still affects me deeper.
Could you talk about when the MC5 decided to leave Detroit and come to Ann Arbor?
Sure. We moved into, I forget the address. It was that those series of structures that were on the corner of Warren and John C. Lodge. Sinclair was living up there for a while. Then he moved to another spot over on 2nd Avenue and Canfield or whatever the next block up is. There was another building there that he took over. So the band moved into his place, and then we had what used to be the storefront for the Artist Workshop as our rehearsal hall downstairs. And, Detroit was a very volatile and dangerous place in those days. And, we came in from a show one night, and we had the committee to end the war in Vietnam. Office was below where we lived, and the right wing, I suspect the John Birch Society fascists, had set the place on fire. We pulled up, and the fire department's putting the fire out. And we had, constant trouble with the Detroit Police Department. They knew who we were, and so they're constantly harassing us and, stop you on the street and pull you over and search you. And we also had, just this kind of round-the-way problems, being in a very poor neighborhood, a high-crime neighborhood. There was a raper who had raped a couple of the women in our sphere. One day we were learning a new song, and we had the record player upstairs, but the band stuff was downstairs, and we were going up. We'd listen to the record, and then we'd come down, and we'd try to figure out how to play the tune. Let's go up and listen again. And someone forgot to lock the door, and when we came down, all the guitars were gone. So then we knew thieves in the neighborhood knew that we were in there. So then we got new guitars. They broke in, stole the next guitars. Then we got another set of guitars, and they followed us to a gig and stole them again. So between our van got firebombed, the police, the rapist, and the thievery, and just the general dangerousness of life in Detroit, and we had gone through the 67 rebellion in Detroit, we just decided we need to go to Ann Arbor where we'll be safe, or safer anyway. It was just too hairy. It stopped making sense. Having cheap rents and a laissez-faire attitude in the neighborhood wasn't worth the pain and misery of it. I mean, it was scary. You didn't know what was going to happen next.
When you were in Ann Arbor, were you hoping that it would be your new home? Did it feel like home, or did you miss Detroit? Was Detroit really home?
No, I didn't miss it. I didn't miss it. I loved Ann Arbor. I thought we were, we had arrived. And when we got to Ann Arbor, we had this big, beautiful house, and that was right about the time that the band was being courted by some record company. So I felt like, we were really making some progress, and we were starting to make money, and we were booked a lot. We performed regularly, so cash was coming in. We could pay for the big house and the 30 people that lived there, and none of us made any money, but we had everything that we needed. So Ann Arbor was terrific for a good while, yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about the concerts in the park?
The free concerts in the park were just an extension of the kinds of things that we did all the time. I mean, our attitude, my attitude is, if you're trying to win fans and create a movement, you've got to play. And so we would play anywhere, anytime anyone would let us. I'm almost still that way. And so when we figured out this idea of playing concerts in the park, we thought, well, this is terrific. Oh, we'll go over there, set up our gear, and start playing. And then people started coming, and became a regular. I think we did them on Sundays. It was regular events, and they were great fun, just terrific.
Do you have a favorite memory of any one of those particular performances?
Yeah, I have one. We were playing in the Bandshell. I think it's West Park. Mm-hmm. Is that West Park? And apparently there was the founder of the John Birch Society owned a home up on top of the hill. And he complained to the police about the profanity. Kick out the jams, motherfuckers. And so when the next week came, we heard about it, and the police were there, and John was talking to the chief of police in Ann Arbor in those days was a guy named Eugene Stoudemire. And he was actually a good guy. He was a peace officer. He came over to our house and introduced himself, and he wasn't in uniform, and you know, you could smell the marijuana, and he said, I don't care what you guys are doing. He wanted to meet us. He wanted to see who we were. Were we really there to start a violent revolution, or, you know, what was our story, you know? And he liked us, and we liked him. So Lieutenant Stoudemire was at the park that day, and he was sitting with John. They were watching the concert up on the hill. And I got it into my mind that, you know, to push it too far. So when we did kick out the jams, I made the crowd say, kick out the jams, motherfucker! Not once. Twice. Three times. While John's sitting there with Lieutenant Stoudemire. And then we played the tune, and I thought, well, it's a great concert, you know, power to the people. And when I got with John later, he was furious with me. You've never seen John mad. His face gets red. And his voice goes up an octave, and he was furious. He said, I'm sitting there with the motherfucker, and you're saying that over and over again. What are you doing? I hate to take joy in John's misery, but it's one of my better memories.
So what was your story? Were you there to incite a violent revolution? Were you?
Well, what were we in Ann Arbor to incite a violent revolution? You know, we had some romantic ideas about what violent revolution meant. You know, we were frustrated as young people in America, and we were in agreement as a generation that the direction the country was going in was wrong, that the war was wrong, that the way people of color were treated was wrong, that the marijuana laws were wrong, that, you know, Bing Crosby and Bob Hope were wrong. It was all wrong, and we rejected it. So the White Panther Party became a way for us to voice our frustration, to align ourselves with the Black Panther Party, to take a militant stance, to buy guns, to talk, you know, to embrace Malcolm X's thinking that political power comes out of the barrel of a gun. These are all dangerous and romantic ideas. And I was a young guy, and I bought into it. And I thought it was exciting, but it was all fantasy. It was all from growing up watching television, where the good guys and the bad guys shoot it out, and you go, and the guy goes, oh, and he winged me, you know. It's not reality, and it was a mistake. It was a mistake we made. It was a mistake I made, and I don't know any other ways to explain it except to say that, you know, it was a crackpot idea, but we didn't know any better. You know, we didn't know how serious what it really meant when you embrace the symbol of violence and the symbol of the gun and the bomb, that you can't control the outcome, and that will generate a reaction in the authorities. And believe me, they have way more guns and bombs and aircraft carriers and that, you know, the whole idea of using violence as a way to make a positive political change is absurd. And, you know, I've discussed this at length with John and Pun, and even my good friend Mark Rudd from the Weather Underground. And Mark told me that the Cubans told the Weather Underground to disassociate from violence. The Vietnamese said, don't go with violence, go with a mass nonviolent people's movement. Even the Black Panther Party said, do not embrace violence. We're going with the free breakfast program. That's sustainable. Because what violence got the Black Panthers was, of course, death squads in cities all across America. Panthers were murdered. And it took a while for me to see the reality that, you know, that this is not a joke. You know, the police aren't joking. You know, when you talk about guns and bombs, they have – They're a paramilitary organization, and they're militarized, and they're trained in weapons and tactics. And real people get killed. You get really dead, and you get really shot, and you get really sent to prison. And these were things that we didn't fully grasp, you know. So you know, on one hand, we talked a good game, but you know, when you look at the history of political change and revolution, and the history of social movements and social progress, violence is, you know, sometimes it happens. I guess you could say it's necessary, but as a strategy, it's a non-starter. It'll blow up in your face, and that's what it did, because we ended up discrediting a legitimate anti-war movement. We ended up doing the FBI's work for them, a legitimate civil rights movement. We discredited them. You know, the power of in Martin Luther King was nonviolence. How do you fight nonviolence? Power has to make a concession to that. Violence they can deal with.
Did you and the band come to that realization concurrently with the White Panther Party coming to that realization? Because they came to that realization at some point too. That's when the Rainbow People's Party name change happened. What was that all part of what was happening in that community, or did you all get there at different times?
I think we got there at different times, because when John went to prison, we were purged from the White Panther Party. We were persona non grata, and you know, and it took a while for us to, by us, I mean me, Tyner, Smith, we were the ones that really were interested in these things. The rhythm section guys didn't care too much about it. But to really develop our own political thinking, our own ideologies, and our own analysis, and to finally, you know, be able to stand on our own feet and not have to have John explain things anymore, but to say, you know what, you know, we're not part of a violent revolution. That, you know, if you're going to use violence, our thinking was, then if you figure more than half the people in the world are going to disagree with you and you're embracing violence, then you got to kill more than half the people in the world. And I said this to a militant German student once in Germany, and he turned to me and he said, no, we think only some thousands will be necessary. That's what I said. Man. Buy this man another beer, and we're not going to talk about this anymore with you, man. You're out of your mind, you know. They ended up being Baader Meinhofs. So, I mean, see, here's the difference between us and them is we went up to the edge, looked over, and we stepped back, you know. Baader Meinhof and many of the Red Army faction and other groups around the world, they went all the way over the edge.
Do you feel that at this point, now 40 years later, the legacy of the MC5 is able to be about the music and has been able to free itself from that rhetoric that was really just rhetoric at the time? And now when people think of the MC5, it's the music that they are being turned on to.
No, I don't think you can separate it. I think that you know, the context that the music emerged out of, you know, the industrial world of Detroit is part and parcel of the music itself. And I think the anger and the frustration of the 60s is also part of that music. I mean, You know, if I think about, you know, where did the, what was the source of the passion that made me want to play that guitar with more velocity, with more power, with more authority, I would put it into my sense of outrage, you know, my militancy, you know, at seeing the Detroit police beat kids mercilessly with no justifiable reason. I mean, when we played the Love-In at Belle Isle, and I watched Detroit police officers play polo with kids' heads on horseback, riding by going thwack, for hippie kids who weren't doing nothing. They were just there to have fun at a free concert. And the police, it was a police riot, you know. And then to live through the rebellion in 67 and see people murdered, see the police just go on a blood rampage for a week, you start to wonder what's going on, you know. And it's infuriating, you know. It challenges your sense of what's right. And you know, how can you sit still? How can you not have a feeling about that? At least I can't. So I don't think you can separate it. I like that people are interested in the music, but I think it's all, you know, you can't separate the musician from the world. You can't take Charlie Parker out of 52nd Street, you know, or it's all part and parcel.
At the same time, though, when we talked with Brett Callwood, he was, I'm pretty sure it was you, he was saying you didn't like that a lot of people thought of the MC5 as proto-punk, or the term didn't really sit with you, whereas that, you know, that spirit of the, you know, the politics and the music is together in that particular idea. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about that.
It's a semantic issue. Originally, you know, when I first heard about this punk rock movement, I was in prison, and punk meant something different then. Punk was the kind of guy that they would knock down and have make your girlfriend, you know, or they have you washing their socks, you know. And, I mean, that was a term of great derision. I mean, those were fighting words. And they could be killing words in prison, you know. So when I would read magazines about these new bands like The Clash and The Ramones and they love the MC5 and they play punk music, I would rip them up and flush them down the toilet because I didn't want anyone to associate me with this punk thing just because of the environment, you know. Punk kind of means it has another meaning coming from my upbringing, you know, in Lincoln Park and growing up in Detroit. You know, if two kids were in a schoolyard and one started calling the other one a punk, then you're probably going to have a fight, you know. So it wasn't until after I got out of prison and really had a chance to see what the punk movement was and that it was the next generation, you know, demanding their own efficacy, you know, fighting for their own voice. And that I realized, well, this is just part of the same thing we did, that, you know, that the jazz guys did before us, that the big bands did before the marching bands, which Beethoven did, which Picasso did, which, you know, every new generation has to demand its own voice. And so in that sense, I, of course, I'm a punk. I'll always be a punk in that sense. But in the old school meaning of the word, that was the only problem I ever had with it.
Could you talk about what it was like to have the responsibility of being the economic engine for 30 people? Because for a while there, the MC5 was the only thing bringing any kind of money into those mm-hmm. street houses and really keeping those people fed mm-hmm. and clothed. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that sense of responsibility that we've got to get out there and we've got to make some money because these people are counting on us?
No. I didn't have any sense of it whatsoever. All I knew is that I was in my band, that I was getting to play more and more for bigger crowds, and everything was going according to my grandiose plots and schemes for my future. And, you know, the fact that we were buying food for 30 people was a great idea as far as I was concerned. You know, I didn't feel any weight from that whatsoever. Probably, you know, part of my youthful egoism, you know, that I just wasn't concerned with those kinds of issues. I was concerned with the music and the band, and 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 and, you know, my own satisfactions and my own accomplishments. I was completely self-obsessed as a young man. I'm still self-obsessed, but
did John and David do that on purpose? Did they keep that stuff from you so that you guys could focus on the band and the music and not have to worry about any of the rest of that, so you could focus on what you were doing?
Well, yeah, but I don't think there was anything sinister to it.
No, and that's not what I meant at all.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't have to worry about it. So
David
it
didn't have
mind.
Anything to do with the MC5. He just was John's brother and our friend and, you know, part of the community. But John, I think John at least understood that, you know, someone needed to collect the money, somebody needed to put it in the bank, somebody needed to write checks. These were all things beyond me. You know, I was about chasing girls and being in my band and you know, causing a disturbance. I was on the rabble-rousing end of the deal.
I wanted to show you this. We pulled it out of our exhibit. Does it look familiar? This is a statement from the band. Each member got to write, answer some questions.
This is for the fan club.
Your religion is Church of Zenta.
Yeah.
Is it still?
No. I don't subscribe to any organized or disorganized religions. I'm highly critical and suspect of religions.
And I like how it says the type of girl you like, natural and freaky.
Well, yeah. Tell my wife about that. She fits. She's natural. She's a freak.
Your favorite entertainers, Archie Shepp, The Who. You still talk about The Who.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And I still love Archie Shepp and John Coltrane and the Fugs. I'm 5'10", 155 pounds. Yeah, I haven't seen those days in a while. This is terrific. Oh, my sister was 16. So I was 20. She's 4 years younger than me. I was 20 years old when I did this. Yeah, it's... I see that footage, the YouTube footage, you know, and I see this ebullient young guy dancing around, playing his guitar, and I think, you know, he has no idea what's ahead for him. You know, there's a thing that happens with young people if they achieve recognition on a large scale. It inflates their ego. They start to think that... that they're right about everything, and there's kind of an infallibility that sets in, and in a way, it's intoxicating. Like if I drink a glass of vodka, I know I'm going to be intoxicated. But if I work real hard and I start to achieve some things in the world, I don't necessarily know that I'm intoxicated, but. You're it's an ego feeding proposition, you know, and everyone you see smiles when they see you coming and girls sleep with you and people give you presents and they laugh at your jokes and everyone sucks up to you. But you don't know what's going on. You just think, or at least me, I mean, I just thought that everything's going the way I planned it to go. This is the way I meant for everything to work out. And I had a plan and everything worked. Until it didn't work anymore, and it's not a unique scenario. You see it over and over in music and in the arts, in particular, where people achieve international recognition at an early age, and then life gets complicated. You know, it's very hard to sustain a career. In the competitive world of the amusement industry, and especially in my case, where the MC5 met so much resistance, you know, we not only had the resistance from the entertainment industry itself, you know, that we were too much trouble, but from the police, the FBI, and so we were effectively, you know, crushed out of the game. But that happens to most bands anyway. Most bands, you know, there's an arc to it. And, you know, you see them come and you see them go. Mostly you see them go. And there's very few bands that sustain over decades. You know, there's The Who and Bruce Springsteen and Rolling Stones. And, you know, there aren't very many that you know, U2, and but you know they all have people die, and you know this old the old adage that the center never holds is never more true than in bands. That however things are today, they're not going to be like this in 5 years. You know, we get together anytime artists get together for a common purpose. They band together and put their energies together. They can achieve a great deal. I mean, look, the Nazis were about 15 people, and they almost took over the whole world. You know, the neocons are probably 10 people, and they've created the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, almost destroyed they've destroyed the economy. So, you know, if you get a few people together, they want to do something, they can generally accomplish it, and most bands do. But things don't stay the same. So when I was faced with the prospects of, you know, the band doesn't exist anymore, you know, all the dreams of the 60s, all the promise, the potential, none of it seemed to be working out. You know, John had gone to prison. And in my case, that's where the wonderful pain-killing properties of Jack Daniels and heroin enter the picture. And it's not unique to me. I mean, it happens over and over and over again. It's amazing how predictable it is. And of course, once you acquire a drug addiction and alcoholism, they bring with them their own sets of problems. And so now you can't contend with your career activities because you're too busy getting high, or at least I was too busy getting high, and things go from bad to worse. So, you know, if I had to do over again, I would have done a few things differently. But, you know, I had nothing to prepare me for that. And I had no community around me. You know, once the band broke up, that was my community. That was my way I made money. Those were my friends. And we live in the world of our relationships with other people. So when those relationships ended, then I'm on my own. And, you know, I made decisions out of fear and out of desperation. And when people are in desperate situations, they do desperate things. And I made really unwise decisions, and it got good to me. I found out there was a way to achieve some status by being bad, and that there was a whole culture, this underworld culture of where it's a reverse culture where good is bad and bad is good. Like hurting somebody is considered good, and robbing somebody is considered good, and scamming somebody is considered good. And I identified with it, and I went with it, and I embraced it. And I wasn't very good at it, and it all blew up in my face. And it ended up with me, you know, with multiple arrests and convictions, and finally a federal prison term. So there were a lot of things I'd have done differently if I could travel back in time. But, you know, today I can tell you that for a long time I thought I'd ruined my life. I'd wasted my life, and I'd wasted 30 years being stoned and a bag of heroin and a bottle of vodka. But, you know, I was able to find a way to live where drinking and drugging wasn't necessary. And I became part of another community of people just like me. And I find out that the things that I thought were me at my worst are the most valuable things that I have. Because if I talk to specifically another musician who's going through the kinds of things that I went through, I can say the one thing that nobody else can say to him or her. You know, the rabbi can't say it, and the therapist can't say it, and the priest can't say it, and his mother can't say it. His friends might not be able to say it, but I can say it. I know how he feels because I did what he's doing. I've been there. I've done that. I can connect with him. That all that I did wrong ends up being the best gift I have to help somebody else. Because part of how I can find this way to live without drinking and drugging is I have to stop being self-obsessed, and I have to start doing something for somebody else, start thinking about somebody else, And it's really, it's cut across my whole life. You know, I learned this idea of being of service to my fellows. And then I look back to my prison experience and I realize that, you know, I'm in a unique position that I have 1 foot in prison still and 1 foot in music. And maybe I could be a bridge to connect those two worlds. So I formed a group with Billy Bragg, and it's called Jail Guitar Doors. And we find people that work in prisons that are willing to use music as rehabilitation, and we provide them with guitars. And we've been into about 8 states' prison systems so far in the federal prison system, and it's the best stuff I do, delivering guitars and talking to prisoners, because I feel like half the time they're the only people that really understand what I'm talking about, you know, because I know these guys. I am those guys, you know. And if they can use a guitar to find a way to express complex feelings that they can't do otherwise, if they can find a way to express themselves, tell their story in a non-confrontational way, process their problems in a non-confrontational way, then I'm cleaning up a little bit of the mess I made. My goal is to leave the place a little nicer than I found it.
To learn more about Wayne Kramer, visit freeingjohnsinclair.org.
AADL Talks to Wayne Kramer has been a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.